He was on his feet. A momentary glimpse of Hyde's appalled, deathly face, and he saw the ship broadside on to the sea.
"Brail up! Clew up, mizzen and main! Foresail sheets aft!" he cried.
Grinding and grinding again over rock, the good Ariel brought her head right before the wind, and he drove her over the narrowest part of the inner reef with what steering the foresail alone would provide. He was still at a great distance, very far removed, but all his mind that was clear felt with the ship, and after the seventh great shattering strike, he knew her back was broken amidships. Yet with spring tide near its height she did not hold fast, but drove on and on through breakers that reared up to her tops. In the calmer water beyond the reef she still swam, she still steered, but it could not last long.
"Guns overboard!" he said.
With their weight gone she would stay afloat long enough for him to run her ashore. A few minutes later, with the wind and the sea and the tide heaving her in towards the mouth of the river, he told the officers to fetch their commissions and see to their affairs. Then he beckoned Stephen, and they went below. The water was already shin-deep in the cabin.
"The colonel must shift into a marine's uniform and pass for a private," he said. "Do you agree?"
Stephen nodded. Jack said,
"I will give the order."
And he gathered up the lead-covered signal book, his dispatches and private papers, and his sword, told the steward to pack what he could, and went back on deck. He threw the signal book, his dispatches, and his sword overboard, spoke to the marine officer about the colonel, and returned to steering the poor, heavy wreck to the shore. For some reason he was perfectly confident that she would not go to pieces, but would bring them to land, and she behaved beautifully to the last. A final heave on the starboard sheet brought her wallowing up against the jetty at the height of the tide, with the water gurgling at her hatches. All they had to do was to step over the rail to the waiting company of soldiers and the small, silent crowd. Chapter 10. In these 20 years of war, quite a number of Royal Navy ships had been wrecked on the coast of Brittany, and some indeed had been taken. The authorities at Brest were used to the situation, and without undue triumph they installed the Ariel's officers in a disused nunnery, her men in the lower parts of the castle, deeply lined with straw. Men so exposed to the caprices of the elements might be expected to develop a philosophical attitude, and before this Stephen had seen his shipmates accept the unkinder strokes of fate with a fine equanimity. But even so, he was surprised to see how quickly they recovered their spirits on this occasion, and put a good face on adversity. It is true that since their ship had not been taken, they had not been pillaged. What little they had been able to save they still possessed, and this softened the blow, since they were able to round out the sparse French rations with better food and wine than ever the Ariel had afforded them. On the other hand, once they found they were not to be robbed or starved, they complained bitterly about the quality of the tea, and on Jack's first visit to the men it was represented to him that this here French bread, full of holes, could not nourish a man. If a man ate holes he must necessarily blow himself out with air like a bladder. It stood to reason. They did not much care for the oatmeal either, probably harvested green and parched in the ear, nor the soup. Among the young men in the nunnery, cheerfulness returned with the sun that shone on Brest from a clear, calm sky within 24 hours of their miserable journey from Tregonek, and with it their naval sense of fun. The commissary, charged with drawing up a correct official list, which included, among other things, their grandmother's maiden names, dates, and places of birth, received some strange answers, delivered in sober, lugubrious tones, so strange that the port admiral summoned Captain Aubrey.
"I refuse to believe, sir," he said, "that all your officers but one are descended from Queen Anne."
"I am sorry to tell you, sir, that Queen Anne is dead," said Jack. "Common decency, therefore, forbids me to make any comment."
"It is my opinion," said the admiral, "that they have replied with a culpable levity. Such parents as the Emperor of Morocco, Creeping Jenny, Guy of Warwick, Sir Julius Caesar. You may say that the commissary is only a mere civilian, which is profoundly true, but even so I must ask you to invite them to treat him with a proper respect. He is the servant of the Emperor."
Jack did not seem very deeply impressed. and in fact the Admiral's voice lacked full conviction. He looked at his captive for a moment and went on,
"But now I come to a far more serious matter. One of your marines, Ludwig Himmelfahrt, has escaped. His clothes have been found in the privy."
"Oh, a sad, shatter-brained old fellow, sir. A supernumerary. We only took him aboard to play the fife when the hands were at the capstan. I doubt he is even on the ship's books. He would not appear among those that have to be accounted for. Nevertheless, sir, I must observe that even as a nominal soldier it was his duty to escape."
"Maybe," said the Admiral, "but I hope you will not attempt to imitate him, Captain Aubrey. I do not care greatly about a half-witted supernumerary, particularly if he was not on the muster-roll, though he must certainly be found. But with a post-captain, an officer of your distinction, sir, the case is altered. And I warn you that at the least attempt you will find yourself incarcerated at Beach. At Beach, sir, and incarcerated."
Jack felt that he was on the verge of a flashing piece of repartee, of one of the best things he had ever said in his life.
"Then indeed I should be bitched." Or, "That would bitch my chances, I'm sure." Or something more brilliant still.
But the want of a true colloquial link between the English bitch and the French chien baffled him. The anticipatory smile faded, and he only said,
"Oh, as for that, sir, I dare say I shall be your guest until the end of the war. Let us hope that it will not be so long delayed that I wear out my welcome."
"I am sure it will not," said the Admiral. "The Emperor is carrying all before him in the north. The Austrians are crushed."
"I have been threatened with bitch," said Jack, returning to the nunnery.
His meaning was instantly clear, for Verdun and Beach had been the chief topic of conversation for the last 5 days, except for a certain amount of talk about the progress of the war as it could be gathered from the Moniteur, and about the young woman who brought Jagiello's meals. Verdun was the town where the prisoners of war were kept. Beach, the fortress where those who tried to escape were confined. Both were well known by rumour as very disagreeable places in the far northeast of France, cold, wet, and expensive, but scarcely anyone in the service knew them at first hand, for since in principle Buonaparte refused to exchange prisoners in the traditional way, and since in fact very few were exchanged, almost all who went there never came back. Yet among those few was Hyde, who as a senior midshipman had escaped first from the one, and then from the other, with three companions, eventually reaching the Adriatic on foot. They listened to his accounts with the utmost attention, which restored some small part of his shattered self-esteem. He had been the only one among them, too low, too miserably unhappy, to give the commissary the usual facetious answers. His details had been plain, dull, and correct. Now Jack asked him to tell them about the fortress once again, with particular reference to the best means of escape, and once again Hyde described the towering sandstone crag, the covered ways, the bomb-proof excavations, the extraordinarily deep well.
"As for escape, sir, the great thing is money, of course, and a map, and a compass. Dried beef and biscuit and a warm coat for when you have to lie up by day, and very stout boots. But the great thing is money. It can do almost anything, and even a guinea goes a long way, English gold being at such a premium here."
Jack smiled. He had a fair amount in his pocket, a surprising amount, quite enough to keep the Ariel's hands in modest comfort for their journey, and he knew that Stephen concealed an inconvenient weight of guineas in his bosom, the funds taken to the Baltic in case of need and entirely untouched.
"A really good knife, and a marlin spike, or at least a fid, come in very handy," Hyde continued, "and a young person for Monsieur Jagiello," said the guard, with a grin.
He stood away from the door, and there was the young person, holding a cloth-covered basket, blushing and hanging her pretty head. The others walked away to the window and talked in what they meant to be a detached, natural way, but few could help stealing glances at the maiden, and none could fail to hear Jagiello cry,
"But, my dear, dear mademoiselle, I asked for black pudding and apples, no more, and here is foie gras, a gratin of lobster, a partridge, 3 kinds of cheese, 2 kinds of wine, a strawberry tart. I made it myself."
said the young person. "I am sure it is wonderfully good, but this is much more than I can ever afford."
"You must keep up your strength. You can pay for it later, or in some other way, or however you like."
"But how?" asked Jagiello, in honest amazement. "By a note of hand, do you mean?"
"Pray, step into the passage," said she, pinker still.
"There you are again," said Jack, drawing Stephen into another room. "Yesterday it was a thundering great patty with truffles, and tomorrow we shall see a wedding cake for his pudding, no doubt. What they see in him I cannot conceive. Why Jagiello, and the others ignored? Here is Fenton, for example, a fine upstanding fellow with side whiskers that are the pride of the service, with a beard as thick as a coconut, he has to shave twice a day, as strong as a horse, and a very fair seaman. But there are no patties for him. However, that is not what I meant to say. The colonel is off."
"I knew it,"
said Stephen, who had visited the castle with the aerial surgeon.
"I thought you might," said Jack. "You do not seem unduly concerned."
"I am not," said Stephen, and after a moment, "you have not seen him at his best. At sea he is out of his element. He talks too much, and you might even take him for a mere blatteroon. But I do assure you, my dear, that as a guerrillero he has not his match. A true fox by land, he will glide down a hedge like a serpent. And while you are beating about the bushes, peering into the ditch, there he is beyond a haystack, a long mile before you. I have known him make his way from Tarragona to Madrid with 100 ounces of gold on his head, and there cut a traitor's throat as the man lay asleep in his bed. No, no, he is well supplied with money. He is rich in experience. He will be over the frontier before we reach Verdun."
"I beg your pardon, sir," said Hyde at the door, "but our dinner is on the table." They ate their meals in what had been the nun's parlour, an austere room, scarcely changed but for stouter bars at the windows, a Judas hole at each of the outer doors, and a number of English inscriptions. J.B. loves P.M. Bates is a fool. How I wish Amanda were here. Letitia, none prettier. J.S., master's mate, etat 47. And now their dinner was spread. It came from the best establishment in the town, recommended by the Admiral, whereas Jagiello had chosen the cheapest cook-shop. Yet it made a poor show compared with his. Only a couple of bass, 2 pairs of fowls, a saddle of mutton, 6 side dishes, and a floating island.
"The mutton was tolerable," said Jack, making the island revolve, "though it lacked red currant jelly. But the French may say what they please. They have no notion of pudding, grande nation or not. This is not even a flummery. It is mere show and froth."
Stephen raised his eyes from his plate, and behind Jack's head he saw the Judas darken. A single eye appeared. It looked upon them at length, barely winking, expressionless, all-seeing. After a while it was succeeded by another, a blue-grey eye, whereas the other had been dark. These eyes watched them alternately throughout the rest of the meal, which consisted of brandy, and although he did not turn his head to make sure, Stephen was morally certain that the other Judas was occupied too, since it gave a different view of the room. He was not altogether surprised, therefore, when Jack and he and Jagiello were called to the Admiral's office, nor at the change in the Admiral's attitude, which had been kind hitherto, if not positively friendly. At some distance from the Admiral's desk sat a middle-aged civilian in a shabby black coat and a fairly white neckcloth. He had grizzled hair and dark eyes. His face was vaguely familiar to Stephen. He took no part in the interview, but watched attentively, as though from a great way off. The Admiral himself concealed his embarrassment behind an appearance of rigour and formality, but he did not conceal it well. He asked Jack a series of obviously prepared questions about his voyage: where from, where to, course followed, date of sailing, nature of convoy, and so on. Jack's manner at once became as stiff and formal as the Admiral's, rather more so indeed. He looked coldly across the desk and said,
"Sir, I have produced my King's commission. I have stated the number of the aerial's crew. By the laws of war, no captured officer is required to do more. With the greatest personal respect for you, sir, I must decline to reply."
"Note down that answer," said the Admiral to his secretary,
and turning to Stephen,
Are you the gentleman who was recently invited to address the Institute?"
"I regret I cannot satisfy you, sir," said Stephen. "My reply must be the same as Captain Aubrey's."
They had a moment's uneasiness about Jagiello, but the young man was no fool. He repeated their words with an equal firmness.
"I have to inform you that your replies are not satisfactory," said the Admiral. "You must therefore proceed to Paris at once for further inquiries."
He rang, and told the orderly to fetch their belongings.
"At once, sir?" cried Jack. "But surely I may see my men before I go. I have not yet seen to their victualling. I appeal to you, sir, as an officer and a seaman. I must have at least a word with them, and give them something to bear their charges. I appeal to your own example, sir. A captain cannot leave his men in the lurch."
"There is no time," said the Admiral. "The carriage is waiting. I have my orders. If I do not receive satisfactory replies, you are to be taken to Paris."
"Then at least, sir," said Jack,
bringing out his purse and laying it on the Admiral's desk,
"at least you will have the kindness to order this to be delivered to them, to a responsible man named Wittgenstein, with instructions to share it out fairly in the course of their march."
The Admiral glanced at the civilian, who shrugged.
"It shall be so, Captain," he said. "I wish you good day. Monsieur Duhamel will show you to the coach."
During the days and nights of their journey, Stephen turned the situation over in his mind. He had plenty of time to do so, since Duhamel's presence prevented all free conversation, while for his part the Frenchman uttered scarcely a word. It was not that he was unpleasant, or authoritarian, or harsh, and although he was certainly taciturn and reserved, he gave no impression of hostility as he sat there in his corner, looking vaguely at the landscape or their numerous well-mounted escort, but rather of detachment, as though he lived on another plane, contemplating them as objectively as a natural philosopher might contemplate the animalculae of his microscope. Now and then Stephen caught Duhamel's eye upon him, and he thought he detected a certain secret inner amusement, an understanding as of one professional for another, caught in a very difficult position indeed. But the knowing black eye would glaze over at once, and return to its watching of the various provinces they traversed. Duhamel seemed immune to boredom, unwearied by their long stages, above human weakness except at mealtimes. At the outset, he suggested that it would be much simpler for all concerned if they were to give their parole not to attempt to escape during the journey, a mere formality since the coach was guarded by a whole troop of horse, and they dined and supped at the best inns in the towns they travelled through, a galloper being sent ahead to reserve a private room, to order particular dishes that varied town by town, and to desire that stated wines should be ready to accompany them. Duhamel did not eat at the same table, nor did he depart from his impenetrable reserve, but he did send over particularly successful dishes. Lamb's sweetbreads in Malmsey, little balls of tripe a man might eat forever, boned larks in a pie. And presently they took to relying wholly on his judgment, although his judgment ran to an extraordinary number of courses, which he ate up entirely, wiping his plate with a piece of bread, a look of quiet satisfaction on his face. He was a spare man, but he seemed unaffected by the quantity he ate and drank twice a day. No sign of a disordered spleen or pancreas, no hepatic disturbance, no heaviness from repletion. It was a remarkable sight. It was remarkable food, and after two of these feasts, for they were no less, Jagiello's spirits, oppressed by his elder's silence, began to revive, and he sang quietly to himself. After another, he toyed with a key bugle, the gift of a lady at Lamballe, until a gleam of sun induced him to lower the glass with the intention of blowing a salute to the sky. Duhamel had been sitting in an apparent abstraction, digesting his turkey poult, but the window was not halfway down. The possible means of escape for a slim, agile youth was not yet open, before he had a revolving pistol in his hand, full cocked and pointing straight at Jagiello. Stephen noticed that it was painted a dull, unshining grey.
"Sit down," said Duhamel.
Jagiello sat down abruptly.
"I was only going to sound a salute," he said in a startled voice, adding, with rather more dignity, "You forget I have given my parole."
The gleam of extraordinary ferocity faded from Duhamel's face, being replaced by a sceptical and disillusioned look.
"You shall blow it during halts," he said. not in the coach. These gentlemen may wish to reflect."
They had little else to do, other than sleep. Jack was gifted that way. Not only had he a great deal to make up, but the enormous meals he ate in obscure competition with the unconscious Frenchman weighed down his eyelids. They weighed down his liver, too, and upset his internal economy. Even before they left Brittany, most of the sauces were based on cream by the pint. In Normandy it was worse, and their halts became even more frequent. Although they travelled with two chamber pots under the seat, Jack's modesty could not do with less than a hedge, or at least a capacious bush, and the disgusted postilions had to draw the coach into the side every few miles or so. Then, at Alençon, Duhamel's judgment failed him. As he walked into the kitchen of the inn, his keen eye perceived a tub of fresh-water crayfish, and although they had not fasted long enough to purge themselves of the filth upon which they had been regaling, he ordered them to be boiled at once.
"Very lightly boiled, just seized, you understand. It would be a crime to spoil their flavour. Such fine, fat beasts."
Stephen's reflections had left him with little appetite, but Jagiello, who did not feel the need to reflect, ate several score, and Jack, muttering
that no Frenchman should outdo him,
kept pace. In his already weakened, upset condition, he became so quickly ill, so obviously and transparently disordered in the middle of an empty road, that at last Duhamel suggested that Dr. Maturin should do something for him, should prescribe physic or take some appropriate measures. Stephen had been waiting for this with mounting impatience.
"Very well," he said, writing on his knee. "If you will have the goodness to tell one of the soldiers to take this to an apothecary, I believe we may travel on in something more nearly resembling comfort."
Duhamel looked at the cabalistic scrawl, considered, and agreed. A trooper galloped off and galloped back again with a horse-sized enema and a number of bottles, some large, some very small. The journey continued. There were no more sudden, urgent halts, no cries of,
"There's a bush ahead!"
Jack dozed most of the way under the influence of his physician's favourite tincture of laudanum, a powerful opiate whose abuse, in time of great emotional stress, had very nearly put an end to Stephen's career, but which he still considered the most valuable substance in the pharmacopoeia. Stephen was happy to see the laudanum bottle, for although he no longer indulged, he liked to have his tincture by. And when, a little short of Verneuil, first Jagiello's and then Duhamel's iron bowels succumbed to the crayfish, he gave them each a dose. He could at the same time have put an end to Duhamel, for he had also renewed his store of sudden death, and in one minute phial he had enough to deal with 50 Duhamels and plenty to spare. But with such an escort it would have served no good purpose, and in any case he had never, as a physician, intentionally injured any man. He doubted that he could bring himself to it, whatever the extremity. They rolled on through the Ile-de-France, three of them somnolent and fasting, and he returned to his reflections. One great disadvantage was the fact that he had been out of touch with Europe for some time, and he had little acquaintance with recent developments in French affairs, particularly in those to do with the various branches of intelligence. He did know, of course, that the French service outdid even the English in their multiplicity, their jealous rivalries, and their struggle for power and control of the secret funds. The army and the navy had each their own, so did the great council, the foreign ministry, the ministries of the interior, of justice, and of the police, none wholeheartedly trusting any of the others, to say nothing of those virtually autonomous bodies, the descendants of the Secret du Roi, charged with the surveillance of the rest and of one another, watchdogs guarding watchdogs, so that at times half the nation seemed made up of informers. He did know that Talleyrand and Fouché and Bertrand were nominally out of office, but he did not know how much influence they still in fact retained, nor what agents still worked for them, though he believed their name was Legion. Where the real power lay at present, he could not tell, nor did he know whose prisoner he was. But he was tolerably certain that if he were in the army's hands, they would torture him. That was also possible in the case of Fouché's successor, if only from revenge. The people in that ministry had suffered much from his activities, but with the soldiers it was probable. The supreme military argument was superior force, physical force, and in many services, not only the French, this led to the use of torture. Stephen had undergone the process once, though not to the extremity, and he dreaded a repetition. He had held out at Port Mahon, but he had been younger then, less battered, and he had the strongest immediate motive for doing so, the direct preservation of the Catalan resistance organizations, no less. Now he was not certain how he would behave. Courage was far from constant in any man, and extreme agony could reduce him to a shrieking, spiritually dominated animal, willing in some cases to make any concession whatever for a moment's relief. He hoped he would bear it. He thought it likely, particularly with a saving grace of anger and contempt. But he was glad, heartily glad, that in the dark green file he had a sure way out. He was by no means as strongly attached to life as he had been in the days of Port Mahon, when apart from his political activities his whole heart was taken up with Diana. But even so he was unwilling to leave it in the infinite squalor of a torture-room, among the vile excitement of the operators and the flood of hatred, for torturers were obliged in self-justification to hate their victim, and obviously the hatred was returned. Diana Villiers. At the time of Port Mahon they had not been on terms, she having bolted with Richard Canning, but it was extraordinary what a stay she had been to him. The pole that held his needle to the north and gave its pointing a significance that it had lacked since her reign came to a sudden end. He thought of her much as they approached Paris. She would surely be there, at the Hôtel de la Motte, rather than in the country. It would take a great deal to move Diana from the most fashionable shops in the world after her long abstinence, and although he was certain that she would never, never part with her great diamond, a fortune in itself, her other jewels would allow her to run riot for years on end. Her connection with him, as far as Paris was concerned, was tenuous in the extreme, that of a travelling companion, physician, and patient, no more, and even if it were known to the police, which he doubted, her living under the protection of La Motte would preserve her from anything but formal inquiries, which she knew how to deal with. In his opinion, the reputation of the French police, except in criminal affairs, was exaggerated. He had found them rather slow and inefficient, timid where the rich were concerned, hide-bound by form, hampered by their rivals, and often corrupt. The traffic increased on either hand. His thoughts returned to the possible reasons for their present position, the possible lines of defence. His own arrest was only too comprehensible, but this treatment of Jack and young Jagiello seemed to have little meaning, unless... His mind ran along a series of hypotheses, none really convincing. After Versailles, where the traffic became thicker still, Duhamel locked the coach doors from within.
"Oh, Lord!" said Jack, starting from his doze. "I shall have to get out."
"So shall I," said Jagiello.
Duhamel hesitated, fingering the key and looking out of the window, for the same imperious urge was upon him too. No, no, it was impossible. The late sun gilded an avenue crowded with carriages, passers-by on either side, and never a bush, never the least shelter to be seen. He called to the postilions to go faster, to the escort to clear the way well ahead.
"It will not be long now," he said anxiously,
his first entirely human utterance in this journey, and sank back into his corner, his hand pressed to his labouring belly, his pale lips tightly closed. Why arrest Jack? Stephen could not see it. He remembered the universal howl of execration that had greeted the imprisonment and the almost certain murder of Captain Wright in 1805, and poor Wright was only a commander, whereas Jack was a fairly senior post-captain. No very great man, perhaps, no admiral, but quite important enough to preserve him from ill treatment, unless they had some unusually convincing pretext. For his own part, Stephen was not unknown in the scientific world. He had nothing like Davy's European reputation, but even so. If only he could advertise his presence, that would be a certain protection, although in his case a pretext would be far easier to find. Always providing they really knew who and what he was. He reflected with some satisfaction that they could not reproach him with any breach of strict neutrality during his visit to Paris. But his satisfaction did not last for long. The pretext was the thing, and a little perjury, a little forgery, would soon produce it. The Duc d'Enghien had been shot on false documents, and he was a very, very much more important man than Stephen. The pretext. Dictatorships were absurdly sensitive to the public opinion they continually outraged. They always had to be in the right, to be morally impeccable. And that was one of the reasons why those who had been much mutilated in their interrogation were rarely allowed to live, whether they had given their information or not. How much did they know, in fact, and what was meant by they? He turned over every faint indication, the Admiral's embarrassment, Duhamel's behaviour to them, the present image of the war as presented by the Moniteur, by the countenance of the people he had seen, the scraps of conversation he had overheard. But now the coach had long since crossed the river, and part of his mind was taken up with following its course through the lamp-lit streets of Paris. The choice of their prison would tell him a certain amount. Duhamel gave a stifled groan. They passed the turning that would have led them to the Faisanderie, and Stephen nodded. At least they were not General Dumanil's prisoners at present. On, without crossing the river, to the Conciergerie, on past the Châtelet, and then at last, sweeping in a strong left-hand turn that produced another desperate groan, they drew up in the dark courtyard of what could only be the temple, although it seemed all wrong in the obscurity, lopsided, obscurely deformed. The temple, thoroughly ambiguous as a prison, but scarcely army at all events. Their entrance into the grim, ancient fortress was unlike any that Stephen had ever known. Duhamel had his door open before the carriage stopped, and followed by Jack and Jagiello, who trampled on Stephen and broke his larger bottle in their haste, he ran into the immense vaulted guardroom where those charged with receiving the prisoners sat among scaffolding and pails. With irresistible impetuosity, they rushed past the deputy governor, his secretary, the turnkeys, and ran on, pale and earnest, down a dark corridor, Duhamel a good length ahead. Stephen was left by a heap of ancient stones among the wondering guards.
"What is the matter with Monsieur Duhamel?"
asked the deputy governor, standing there with a list in his hand.
"I believe he has an urgent need," said Stephen. "Pray, sir, what are they doing to the poor old temple?"
"Alas, sir, they are pulling it down at last," said the deputy governor,
and then, looking inquisitively at Stephen,
"I do not believe I have the honour of your acquaintance," he said.
"That is soon repaired," said Stephen with a bow. "My name is Maturin, at your service."
"Ah, Monsieur Maturin,"
cried the deputy governor, looking at his list.
"Just so. Forgive me, I had taken you for... Give yourself the trouble of going with these gentlemen for the necessary formalities."
Stephen had been in several prisons, but they had all been underground. And when, after the necessary formalities, which included a thoroughly professional search, he and his companions were led away, it seemed to him unnatural to walk up flight after flight of worn stone stairs. Yet up they went, up and up, and along an echoing corridor to three communicating rooms, two with pallets, one with a bed, all dimly seen by lantern light, and there they were left in the darkness. After a long and black but airy night, a cruelly disturbed night for Jack, an anxious one for Stephen, a night peaceful only for Jagiello, whose brisk young bowels had quite recovered after the last upheaval, the grey creeping dawn gave them the first clear notion of their quarters. Three little, very dirty rooms leading into one another, each with a barred window looking out onto a towering great blank wall on the other side of the dry moat, and each with a judased door onto the corridor. So many doors and windows in so small a space, so high up, were enough to ensure a strange complication of draughts. But they were not all, since the first room had still another door in the left-hand wall, blind and immovably bolted on the far side, as well as a corbelled projection jutting from the tower, a primitive jakes or privy dating from the Templars themselves, through whose open base the wind came howling in whenever it happened to be in the north or east. It seemed that until recently the rooms had been inhabited by a single man, a prisoner of some distinction, for there was a reasonable bed in the first room, and a washhand stand with a tap from a cistern under the leads, while he had taken his meals in the second, and the third had been his study or music room. There were still some tattered books in a corner, and a disjointed flute. And judging by the greasy marks in the deep-cut window-seat that he and no doubt other generations of prisoners had left, it was here that he had spent most of his time. This was the only window from which they could see much, the others being little more than shafts in the great cold thickness of the wall. But here, by craning out against the bars, they had a view of the moat below, the wall beyond, and of a file of corbelled privies stretching away on the left hand, each with a strong growth of vegetation below it, favoured by some 600 years of enrichment. This was their view on the first morning, and having craned, Stephen said that they were in the Corsi Tower, probably on the side facing the Rue de Neuf Fiancés, the side away from the Great Tower.
"The Great Tower of what, if you please?"
asked Jagiello.
"Why, of the temple. The temple where the king was imprisoned," said Stephen, "and most of his family."
"The temple where they killed poor Wright," said Jack in a sombre voice, and he gave the guard a sombre, dangerous look when the man came in, rattling his keys, to ask whether these gentlemen wanted the ration or whether they preferred to send out.
The search had removed such dangerous things as their razors and Stephen's surprising store of money. The searchers had not found his sudden release, nor could they have done so unless they had searched his vitals, but they had given a receipt for all the rest, stating that the prisoner might draw on the sum for food and approved comforts. Spirits were not allowed, nor any publications other than the Moniteur. These gentlemen might have the ration, the prison ration, said the guard, a melancholy man, or they might send out for their victuals. If they chose to send out, Rousseau, tapping his pendulous, middle-aged belly, was at their service for a very modest consideration. The jailer was a slow, heavy man, but he knew to a penny the sum that had been taken from the prisoners. There were rich pickings to be had here, and his air was as nearly civil as he could make it. Besides, there was no real ill nature in his vague, thick-boned face, though his spirits were obviously very low indeed.
"I should like the ration," said the penniless Jagiello.
"Nonsense," said Stephen, and to Rousseau,
"we shall certainly send out. But before that, I must ask you to tell the surgeon that the gentleman here is in urgent need of his attention."
Rousseau slowly turned his head to Jack, who was indeed most ghastly pale, and contemplated him for a while.
"We have no surgeon, sir," he said at last. "The last left 3 weeks ago. And to think we once had 7, and our own apothecary. Oh, the pity of it all!"
"Then you will present my best compliments to the deputy governor, and tell him I should be grateful for an interview at his earliest convenience."
The governor's convenience was far earlier than Stephen had expected. Rousseau came back within minutes, and led him, between 2 soldiers, down the many flights of stairs. The turnkey's spirits were still very low, but at one particular corner he stopped to point out a hollow cut into the stone, an inverted shelf.
"That is where we always used to rest the coffins, before taking the awkward turn," he said.
"Mind your steps, sir."
"And to think we once had a coffin maker of our own, busy every day the good God made."
The governor's approach was stiff and formal, but it was by no means harsh or authoritarian, and after a while Stephen thought he detected something almost conciliatory, something of the nervous uneasiness he had noticed elsewhere in France, a perhaps not altogether conscious feeling of no longer being quite certainly on the winning side. The governor regretted the absence of an official surgeon, and agreed that outside advice might be called in.
"Though, since you are yourself a physical gentleman," he said, "I will have the drugs sent for at once if you wish to prescribe."
That did not suit Stephen's book at all.
"You are very good, sir," he said, "but in the present case I should prefer a second opinion. In these circumstances I do not choose to take the responsibility myself. Captain Aubrey is a very influential man in his own country, where his father is a member of Parliament, and I should be most unwilling to have to answer for any unfortunate event. I had thought of calling in Dr. Larry."
"The Emperor's surgeon, sir?"
cried the governor, staring.
"D-
Do you speak seriously?
We were students together, sir, and he was present when I had the honour of addressing the Institute earlier in the year, said Stephen with a simplicity of truth, and he observed that the blow went home. But since I see in the Moniteur that he is spending the rest of the week at Metz, perhaps the local man will do for the moment.
There is a Dr. Faber at the end of the street, said the governor. I will send for him.
Dr. Faber was very young, newly installed, very shy, very willing to please. He came at once, and for some reason, perhaps connected with the prison's prestige, the governor saw fit to stun him with Stephen's eminence. Dr. Faber had not actually attended Dr. Maturin's lecture at the Institute, he said as they walked upstairs, but he had read an account of it, and he had been amazed by the constellation of scientific and medical luminaries present, including his former professors, Dr. Larrey, Dr. Dupuytren. He had the honour of being known to Monsieur Gay-Lussac, he whispered, just outside the door. He examined the patient, agreed with Dr. Maturin's diagnosis, agreed with the proposed remedies, hurried off to compound them himself, and returned directly, bearing bottles, pills, and boluses. They talked for a while before he left, mostly about the Paris medical and philosophical world, and Stephen showed away in a somewhat disgusting fashion, speaking of his publications and naming the great men he knew, and saying as they parted, "Should you see any of my friends, dear colleague, pray give them the good day from me."
I shall," said the young man. "I see Dr. Dupuytren, for example, every Tuesday at the Hôtel Dieu, and sometimes Dr. Larrey from a distance."
"You do not happen to know Dr. Baudeloc, the accoucheur, by any chance?"
"Indeed I do. My wife's brother married his sister's niece. I can almost call him kin."
"Ah? I consulted with him when I was last in Paris, leaving my patient in his hands, an American lady. There may well be some difficulty of presentation, the result of a long sea voyage. He was not altogether easy in his mind, I recall. If you should happen to see him, be so good as to ask him how she does. It was an interesting case. And when you come to see our dysentery here on Friday, please bring me half a dozen of Michel's finest glass ampoule."
"I am glad that it is done," said Stephen, listening to the footsteps as they faded down the corridor. "It was odious, and I wonder that decent young man did not revolt. But at least there is now much less likelihood of our being quietly shuffled off. Never was there such a talkative, intermarried, clannish band as the Paris physicians, and once our presence is known... Now, swallow this good bolus, my dear, and you will feel better tomorrow. You may even have a little of our coffee, of the coffee that we must now put in hand." Rousseau returned from leading Dr. Fabre away, and Stephen said to him, "Certainly we shall send out. The question is, where? This gentleman, meaning Captain Aubrey, must have his new-laid egg, his gruel and rice water, fresh and fresh, and for my part I like my coffee hot."
"There is no difficulty," said the guard. "I know a little place not 100 yards from here. Madame Veuve Laidot cooked dishes at all hours, choice wines."
"Then let us by all means send to the widow. Fresh milk and plain crumb bread for these gentlemen, coffee and croissants for me, particularly strong coffee, if you please."
Rousseau took no notice of this, but pursued the one idea already in his head.
"Some clients like to send out to voisins, à Roules, and such places. Some clients like to fling their money out of the window. I do not wish to impose my views on any client. No one can say that Rousseau has imposed his views on any client, and tastes differ. The last gentleman here, and he was a very high gentleman too, sent out to Roules, whatever I might say. And what happened? He died of a pneumonia in that very bed."
Pointing to it, and indeed patting the counterpane.
"Died the afternoon you came in. I dare say you still felt it warm, sir. Which reminds me, I promised him a board for the shithole, pardon the expression. The last one fell out. He always was an awkward companion, and grew worse with the rheumatism fairly bent double at the end. May he rest in peace."
"Then let us send to Madame Laideux," said Stephen.
Rousseau ploughed straight on.
"I do not say it is the Emperor's table. I will not deceive you, gentlemen. It is only an honest cuisine bourgeoise. But such a civet de lapin," kissing his thick fingers, "such a truly velvet poule à peau. And the great point is you get your dishes hot. I always say food must be hot. It is only a small place, but it is not a stone's throw from here. It is in the Rue de Neuf Fiancés, without a word of lie. So the food can be brought in hot, if you understand me.
Then let us send to Madame Lehideur, said Stephen. Milk, crumb bread, coffee and croissants, and please to mention particularly that the coffee should be strong.
The coffee came, and it was strong. Hot, strong, and wonderfully aromatic. The croissants unctuous, but not too unctuous. It was a remarkably good breakfast, all the better for being so late, certainly the best that Stephen had eaten in any of his prisons. He felt stronger, more capable of dealing with most emergencies that might arise. Delation, the sudden treachery of a captured or a double agent, even severe interrogation. He was prepared. He had long been prepared for many eventualities, but not for neglect. It astonished him, took him quite aback, made him feel obscurely foolish, though at the same time still more deeply apprehensive. Day after day they saw no one but Rousseau bringing up their food, or peering at them surreptitiously through the Judas, and once a week the barber, a deaf mute, and after what was by the calendar a very short time, they fell into so even a course of life that they might have been there for months. The only break in the steady pace was that early Friday when Dr. Fabre returned. He viewed Captain Aubrey with approval, and listened conscientiously to the effect of the potions, boluses, and pills. But he was a sad young man, almost distracted, almost overwhelmed with unhappiness, for he had received orders to join the 107th Regiment of the Line somewhere in the gloomy wastes of Northern Europe, in a town whose name he could not even pronounce. Unless he could obtain a most improbable exemption, his nascent practice was ruined. He had been hurrying about among all the influential men he knew, however remotely, in the hope of their good word. He had seen Dr. Larry, and he was most grateful for having been able to use Dr. Maturin's name as an introduction to his own plea. Indeed, Dr. Maturin's name had been most valuable to him as he made his rounds. They all remembered him. Dr. de Buitrin, Dr. Baudeloc, they were all deeply concerned at Dr. Maturin's predicament, were convinced it was an administrative error and that it would soon be set right, would make representations in the proper quarters, offered their services if there were material difficulties of any kind. And Dr. Baudeloc had given Fabre a message about the American patient. His misgivings had been confirmed, and he was by no means sure that the fetus was viable. There was a history of prolonged, violent seasickness, and that might be one of the causes. But in any event, Dr. Baudeloc could not be at all confident that the lady would arrive at term.
"Just as well," observed Stephen. "There are far, far too many children as it is."
"Oh, surely, sir," cried Dr. Fabre, who had five, with another due in a few weeks' time.
"Surely, sir," said Stephen, "no thinking man will deliberately entail life upon still another being in this overcrowded world perpetually at war."
"Perhaps, sir," suggested Fabre, "not all children are deliberately begotten."
"No," said Stephen, "if men were to consider what they were at, if they were to look about them and reflect upon the cost of life in a universe where prisons, brothels, madhouses, and regiments of men armed and trained to kill each other are so very common, why, I doubt we should see many of these poor, mewling little larval victims, so often a present misery to their parents and a future menace to their kind."
Tears gathered in the young man's eyes, but recollecting himself, he put his hand in his pocket and said,
"Here are the ampoule you asked for."
Thank you, dear colleague," said Stephen, taking them carefully in their wooden box. They were for his own private use, for his more certain exit in case of need. "I am very much obliged to you."
"Not at all," said Fabre,
and he took his leave, saying that he doubted whether he should ever have the happiness of seeing Dr. Maturin or his companions again. They did not see him again, and the weeks flowed by in such a calm monotony that presently the charged ampoule came to seem absurd. The long, even days were marked by a steady thumping, by the whistles of foremen, by the distant crash of falling masonry, and the cries of workmen as they demolished parts of the ancient building out of sight. The nights were perfectly calm, with never a sound but the murmur of the city like a distant sea, and the deep bell of Saint Theodule's telling the hour. No hint of footsteps overhead, no sound from either side. They might have been alone in that great tower. They might even have been at sea, as far as their isolation was concerned. And there was something nautical about their small living space, and in the way they became so soon acquainted with it. On the other hand, the quality of their food was not nautical at all. Oh, far, far from it. From that very first cup of coffee, the widow Leydeau gave the utmost satisfaction. Her meals quickly became part of their daily pattern, and their chief diversion. She was very willing to do her best, and she sent little beautifully written, badly spelt notes with suggestions according to the state of the market, and to these Stephen replied with comments on the last dish, and recommendations, even receipts for the next. "It is only a woman's cookery, to be sure," he said, toying with a chocolate mousse, "and I do not know that I should trust her with game, but within these wide limits, how very good it is! She must be a knowing old soul, with great experience, no doubt in excellent service before the Revolution, perhaps something of a slut. Your amiable slut makes the best of cooks." Their daily life, though confined and dull, might have been very much more disagreeable. It quickly assumed an ordered shape. Jack did not exactly organize them into watches, but he showed them how the place could be brought to something like naval cleanliness, with nothing but the most primitive means, and a mere three sweepings in the course of the day. His pupils were sluggish, inept, reluctant, even sullen at times, and they particularly disliked hanging their blankets and their pallet beds from Jagiello's window, piling all the sparse furniture into a pyramid, and swilling the floor before breakfast. But his moral force, his conviction that this alone was right, overcame them, and the rooms grew inoffensive at least, so much so that the former prisoner's tame mouse became uneasy, and disappeared for 3 days. It lived behind the locked door in Jack's room, and it came out of its hole in time for their first breakfast. Though hesitant and confused at finding its friend gone and strangers sitting at the familiar table, it had accepted a piece of croissant and a little coffee held out at arm's length in a spoon. It sat with them while they discussed the methods of dealing with the surrounding filth, and all seemed well, until the unfortunate orgy of scrubbing. The mouse did come back in time, however, and Stephen noticed with concern that it was gravid. He ordered cream. Cream was eminently medicinal in pregnancy. It did not need the mouse, nor her condition, to bring Diana to his mind. She was there a great deal of the time. But it did tend to bring these wandering thoughts, recollections of her in former days, riding over the English countryside with singular grace and spirit, images of her in India, at the Institute, in the streets of Paris, to a sharper focus. Diana would be well provided with cream. Would she also be provided with a lover, with a plurality of lovers? It was probable. He had scarcely known a time when it was not so, and the atmosphere of Paris was ideally suited to such things. Yet he found himself curiously unwilling to dwell on the subject. He preferred to think of the solitary huntress he had once known. Order and cleanliness were the first things in Jack's day, but they were very far from being uppermost in his mind. Their first dinner had not arrived, the floor was scarcely dry, before he was looking about for means of escape in spite of the sickness that had made the others insist upon his taking the one good bed, while Stephen urged him to return to it. Although the prospect was not encouraging, a sheer drop to the moat, an apparently impossible wall beyond it, and according to Stephen's recollection of a visit to the temple in his youth, covered ways barring the moat on either hand, out of their sight, Jack found that others had been there before him. Some patient hand had picked and picked at the setting of the bars in Jagiello's window, gnawing deeply but ineffectually into the stone. Another had actually sawn through one of the 24 pieces of iron, hiding the cut with grease. Indeed, an eye that searched with greater eagerness than any jailer could find countless signs of their predecessor's passionate desire for freedom. Yet it seemed to him that most of them had set about it in the wrong way. Even if one had the tools, one could not work on the bars without risk of detection. They could be seen from the Judas holes, and there was no telling when a patrol might come round. Rousseau and his mates wore list slippers, and they were rarely heard until the key was in the lock. The privy was far more promising. Its projecting floor consisted of 2 spans of stone resting on corbels either side, with the necessary space between them, and if they could be removed, the way was clear. the way down, at all events. Unfortunately, they were built in the lavish medieval fashion, regardless of weight, and they were sealed into the masonry on either side with molten sulphur. But there was at least a possibility that they might be moved in time, and the discreet hanging that covered the entrance to the privy shielded the worker from view, providing all the time in the world. The difficulties would be uncommonly great, however, and the place itself was very, very nasty. Before exploring it farther, he considered the door in the wall, the door used only by the mouse. A lever could work wonders with a door, even so massive an iron-bound, iron-studded door as this. But before working wonders, it was as well to know where the door led. Stephen was of opinion that it might possibly open onto a spiral staircase in the thickness of the wall. The Templars had been much given to spiral staircases. But on the other hand, it might only lead into other rooms like their own, and they would merely exchange one cage for another. Rousseau provided no information about the door.
"It was shut," he said. "It was not open. It was a very old door. They did not make doors like that nowadays."
It might have been prudence on his part, though stupidity seemed more likely than caution or ill will, but they dared not press him. On other subjects he was more communicative, above all on the decadence of the temple.
"The finest prison in France, whatever the conciergerie might say. Such clients! The whole royal family at one time, to say nothing of bishops and archbishops and generals and foreign officers. Very select. No complaints, though some of them were here for years. Always contented. Shitholes and running water in many of the appartements, for cells they could not be called. And all this going to rack and ruin. Barely a score of clients now. That was why he could spend 5 minutes chatting with these gentlemen. In the good old days, with 5 or 6 in a room, he and all his colleagues were run off their feet. Scarcely time for so much as good day. Though it was true that they more than doubled their wages in commission from the cook shops then. Whereas now it was stark misery. Rack and ruin. The whole place was topsy-turvy, arsy-versy. Governor had not been seen this last month and more, said to have resigned. Deputy Governor out of his wits and likely to be replaced.
As for the demolitions, his muddled account was obviously falsified by his wish that they should be kept to a minimum, but it seemed that everything except the great tower and perhaps its companion was to be swept away. Much had already gone.
"And how can you be expected to keep a prison just so in such circumstances, with workmen all over the place, disobeying the regulations?" he asked. "It is more like a bawdy house."
All things being considered, the door seemed less profitable than the privy, from which free air and free-flying house martins could actually be seen.
"Once we have shifted these stones," said Jack, "I shall make a rope of our sheets and reconnoitre the moat."
He concentrated his efforts upon the jakes, therefore, but his efforts were not what they might have been. The crayfish, or rather their effects, were still with him in spite of Stephen's doses and his rigid diet. He was drained of strength, and even, at times, of spirit. Stephen begged him to abstain from such a very noisome atmosphere.
"I do assure you, my dear," he said, "that if you continue to breathe the mephitic exhalations of 600 years of misdirected filth, your escape will be by way of a coffin, rather than a rope of knotted sheets. Come, let Jagiello and me take our turn at undermining the jakes, each for a stated period of the day."
"Very well," said Jack, with a pale smile.
It was but fair to let them have their turn, although he knew very well how it would end. He had no opinion whatsoever of Stephen as a man of his hands, and not much more of Jagiello. Landsmen seemed born inept, and in addition to that, Stephen was given to dreaming, to building hypotheses rather than destroying the temple, and indeed he dropped their only nail down through the slabs into the moat below, while Jagiello was too volatile to accomplish much. He would be set to scrape a particular patch of filth, or to scratch the mortar of a given stone, and then, at the end of his spell, often cut short by Jack's impatience at his fumbling, it would be found that he had dispersed his efforts over much of the privy, exploring new crevices, clearing irrelevant areas of antique dung, and once even inscribing Amor vincit omnia on the roof. He would do his spell cheerfully, singing much of the time, but the prospect of escape was so very, very remote that he had no sense of urgency. He quite lacked the sacred fire that had enabled Jack to eat right through one of the 7 broad Roman bricks that sealed the left-hand side of the inner stone in less than 5 days, using one of poor Madame Ledieu's knives, ground down to a slim steel tooth. Then, once his spell was over, he felt that his duty was done, and he would return to his window-seat, there to sing in his sweet tenor, or to play the flute that Jack had mended. It never occurred to him to steal hours from the night to grind away at the massive brick and stonework, and indeed neither of them ever heard Jack at his self-appointed task, a gigantic rat gnawing at its cage in the darkness with infinite patience and determination. In the end, as he had foreseen, Jack's turn assumed greater and greater proportions, and although Stephen and Jagiello protested that he did too much, far more than his fair share, they were obliged to confess their own comparative inefficacity. So, on a day of unusual activity among the workmen below, labouring unseen but clearly heard behind the wall on the far side of the moat, Jack was in his privy, Jagiello at his window, where their newly washed shirts fluttered from the bars, and Stephen in the middle room, lost in thought, when the upper half of the outer wall fell with a long, thunderous crash. The dust cloud cleared, and there were the roofs and garrets of the Rue de Neuf Fiancés. All the visible windows were shuttered, except one, the nearest, and from this a young woman gazed at the great line of fallen stone. "Woo-hoo!" called Jagiello, smiling and waving his flute. She was the first person he had seen outside the prison for weeks. She looked at him, smiled back, made a slight gesture with her hand, and withdrew, but could be seen still watching him from within. After a while she emerged again, studying the sky, the perfectly clear and cloudless sky, holding out her hand to see whether perhaps rain were falling. Jagiello also held out his hand. She laughed, and they contemplated one another for some time with mutual satisfaction, making motions towards the fallen wall and putting their hands to their ears to show that it had made a noise in falling. Stephen watched them steadily from a discreet point well within the dark middle window. "Stay there," he cried as Jack came backing out from his hole. "Do not approach Jagiello's room. You may look from this window here. See? A female form. I believe we may have the classical situation, the captive, the maiden. It is ludicrously hackneyed, but if you appear, all is lost."
"How do you mean, all is lost?"
"Brother," said Stephen, laying his hand on Jack's arm, "I am not a romantic figure, nor, forgive me, are you."
"No," said Jack, "I suppose I ain't."
He peered through the central shaft, fingering his 6 days' beard. It was bright yellow and all-invasive. Stephen's was black and sparse. Jagiello's face alone was smooth, as though the barber had passed that morning. The lady had returned. She was watering her pot-plants, unconscious of any gaze, and whistling gently to a dove in a wicker cage. "Oh, what a pretty creature!" he said. "Lord, what a pretty creature!" And then, in a strong quarter-deck voice, "Mr. Jagiello, play a melancholy air! Then sing, 'Stone walls do not a prison make.' Do you hear me there?" Jagiello was still in fine voice when their dinner appeared. The young woman was watering her plants again.
"The worst has happened," said Rousseau. "I was afraid of it. They have started on the outer wall. Another month, and where shall we be? The finest prison in France flung down. I dare say they will put you in the conciergerie, my poor gentleman. No running water, no shitholes there, pardon the expression. Only pots, which are low. And what will happen to me, I do not know. Rousseau will be flung aside, his long services forgotten."
He put down the basket and said,
"It is immoral. It is what I call immoral."
He stared out of the window.
"Immoral. And illogical. Illogical, that's the word. But at least you can see Madame Ledieu now. There she is, watering her flowers."
"Let us hope they are aquatics," said Stephen, as he looked at the note lapped in his napkin. or at least swamp plants. Nothing else will survive such assiduity. "If the gentlemen have any washing, mending, or ironing," he read aloud, "B. Lehideux would be happy to accommodate them."
"Oh, we do very well," said Jagiello. "Captain Aubrey was so very kind as to mend my waistcoat yesterday. You cannot see the tear, and he has already shown me how to sew on buttons and darn stockings."
"Nonsense," said Stephen. "These sheets are only dabbled in cold water. I like my shirts ironed. I like them to smell of lavender. Your uniform breeches with a cherry-coloured stripe do you no credit, Mr. Jagiello. They need pressing. Monsieur Rousseau, pray take these shirts, these breeches, and this coat to Madame Lehideux with our compliments. Tell her it will be a great relief to be shot of the shirts in particular. There is something lamentably squalid about shirts flying from the bars, and I do not let on to be either a seamstress or a laundrymaid. Say we are very much obliged to her for her kindness, particularly the young gentleman here."
Shirts no longer flew from the window bars, and Jagiello was in full voice, full flute, full view, all day. He was excused sweeping, swabbing, scrubbing the table and chairs. He was excused all duties, and required to make himself agreeable. Jack and Stephen kept well out of sight, but as far as they could tell, he seemed eminently successful. Apart from their daily letters, more and more voluminous, the two communicated by means of an alphabet, held up, by singing together, and by signs. It was a laborious conversation, taking up most of their waking hours, and how the poor young lady found time to cook their meals and deal so beautifully with their clothes did not appear. The quiet, ordered days dropped by. The mouse brought off a creditable brood. In the Moniteur, Stephen read a categorical denial of the report, busily circulated by the now desperate allies, that there was a coolness between France and Saxony. On the contrary, the friendship between His Imperial Majesty and the Saxon King had never been closer, and there was not the least hint of disaffection among the valorous German troops. The Emperor, by a judicious shortening of his lines of communication, was going from strength to strength. A continual stream of brick and stone dust fell from the privy. Small pieces of masonry were hidden in their beds, and all round them the temple slowly crumbled away. Rousseau grew steadily more glum and silent. It was rumoured that even the towers were not to be spared, and indeed on a Monday they saw workmen enter their part of the moat, leaving heaps of stone and even ladders by the half-demolished wall, a sight frustrating almost beyond endurance.
"Jagiello," said Jack, "unless you spread more canvas, they will have pulled the place to pieces before we can get out. Proper flats we shall look if we are transferred, just when I have the cross-stones almost free. I must have a cold chisel, a handspike, and some line. With the right tools I could do more in an hour than in a week of scraping. I really must have the right tools, and I must have them now."
"I will do my best, sir," said Jagiello, "but I doubt whether the moment is quite ripe."
"Never mind manoeuvres," said Jack. "Always go straight at 'em. Things are growing very urgent indeed, and there is not a moment to lose."
"Shall I risk everything at one throw?"
"Yes, do."
"What am I to ask for?"
"A cold chisel and 5 fathoms of 1-inch line. That will make a capital beginning."
Jagiello walked slowly into his room. They heard him playing in the window-seat.
"The soft, complaining flute in dying notes discovers the woes of hopeless lovers," observed Stephen.
"Oh, what a damned unlucky thing to say!" cried Jack. "I have no notion of your hopeless at all. The dear creature has acquiesced in the disappearance of her cutlery. Why should she balk at a cold chisel or two and a few fathoms of line? I wish you would not say things like that, Stephen."
"It was only a quotation," said Stephen.
Quotation or not, Jagiello came back after a long hour of silence, looking pale, desperate, desolate. He shook his head, and looking across the moat, they saw that the window was quite blank, its shutters closed.
"Never mind," said Jack as they ate their supper.
A supper that seemed unusually plain and sparse.
"Never mind. I shall get a purchase under the nearest stone before the week is out. Never take it to heart, man. I am sure you did your best."
"It is not that, sir,"
said Jagiello, pushing his plate away and leaning over the back of his chair to hide a tear.
"It is that I miss her so. She says she will never see me again."
They looked anxiously at the window. Even its pot plants and the dove had been taken in. A great many thoughts passed through Jack's mind, among them a pang of regret for his coat, which he had sent across to be freshened and which might now be gone forever, leaving him in his shirt sleeves. But in view of Jagiello's distress, he did not mention it. Nor did he mention the dismal prospect of having to say farewell to that splendid succession of meals. Stephen wondered very much what Jagiello could possibly have said to spoil so promising a situation. Yet, for the same reason, he went to bed with the question still unresolved. They saw no chink of light through the shutters in the darkness. The shutters were not opened at dawn, nor yet when the sun shone full upon them. This seemed final, for they knew, she was not always quite discreet, that it was her bedroom, and so decided a removal did away with doubt, with hope, with all but a forced and unconvincing cheerfulness. Yet, to their astonishment, their breakfast came, and with it Jack's shining coat. The basket contained Jagiello's Lithuanian delight, smoked eel and slices of yellow cheese, while neatly tacked inside the coat they found a length of very strong silk cord and a cold chisel in each pocket. Jagiello sprang from the table with a radiant face. They saw the garret window open. The lady and her pot plants and her bird appeared. She arranged the pots in the sun, and then, with a significant look and the kindest smile, she took the dove from its cage, kissed it, and launched it in the air. Chapter 11. This was not Rousseau's time, but he could be heard clashing his keys some way off, and he had two soldiers with him. Their boots echoed in the long vaulted passage. Stephen made the necessary signal to Jack, who backed out of the privy, brushing the brick dust from his hands.
"Dr. Maturin, if you please," said Rousseau, in the open door, and cocking his ear towards the farther room. "How the young gentleman does sing, to be sure. You would say a canary bird." "Mind your step, sir," he said at the coffin turn. "Wait here a minute," said the governor's secretary at the bottom of the stairs, and as Stephen stood there between his guards, he heard voices raised in disagreement on the far side of the governor's door. Most unfortunately, the soldiers and the turnkey fell to discussing the weather. Fine, but perhaps too fine. Perhaps the prelude to a storm, certainly the prelude to a storm. But even so, he gathered that the governor was uneasy about some irregularity, and that his interlocutors were trying to overcome his objections by reason, persuasion, and hectoring. They reached a compromise.
"He is to be returned before the closing of the gates, and both of you must sign for him," said the governor's weak, anxious voice. And then, "Come in."
There were not two men with him, but three, all soldiers. A big, burly, full colonel with a red, ill-tempered face, presumably Hector, a nondescript captain, and a dark, intelligent-looking lieutenant in the sombre uniform of the artillery. As he walked in, Stephen said, "Gentlemen, good day." The governor and the lieutenant replied. The captain moved his lips. The colonel merely stared. A clerk brought papers. The colonel and the captain signed. The lieutenant said to Stephen, "This way, if you please," and they walked to a carriage in the courtyard. The workmen had made great progress since last Stephen saw the entrance to the temple, and now that the outer bailey was gone he would not have known the place but for its position. The covered ways traversing the moat now stood open to the sky, and the gatehouse itself was no more than a disordered heap of stones, being carried away by a long file of carts. After some disobliging remarks about the awkward old sod, "Civilians always the same. They want their arse kicking, just like natives. A whiff of case shot every 3 months," which seemed to be directed at the deputy governor, the colonel and the captain talked about their private affairs with a brutal, truly military disregard for their companions. The two were evidently related, a certain Hortense being the wife of the one, sister to the other. But even if their conversation had been much more interesting, Stephen was far too taken up with his thoughts and with observing their route to pay real attention. They crossed the river by the Pont au Change, as though their destination were the ill-omened Conciergerie. But the loud metallic voices never ceased discussing Hortense, and presently they were driving towards Saint-Germain-des-Prés. "It will be the Rue Saint-Dominique," said Stephen to himself. "Even worse." At the height of the abbey, the colonel stopped the coach and told his orderly to fetch a parcel from one of the little shops behind, and it was just as the man was coming back that Stephen saw Diana. She was in an open carriage talking earnestly to another woman, an over-ornamented woman he had never met. She was bending forward to the front seat with that peculiarly supple grace that he would have known at any distance. And now they were not 6 feet apart. He instantly shielded his face with his hand and watched her through his fingers.